This is the state of things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao. The news cycle was a blur yet again this week. It began with U.S. concerns over how Iran would retaliate for Qasem Soleimani's death, news that former National Security Advisor John Bolton is willing to testify if subpoenaed in the impeachment trial, and Democratic presidential candidates vying for position on the debate stage. By the time the political junkie Ken Rudin joins us on Fridays, the top stories have shifted many times over, but we always welcome his analysis. Ken Rudin, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much, Anita.
So the latest news, the latest, the Trump administration announced new sanctions this morning on Iran affecting industries including construction, manufacturing, textiles, other sanctions targeting Iranian senior officials. Trump had indicated that more sanctions might be coming. But I'm wondering, from your perspective, looking at this longer history of our relationship with Iran and all of the ticks in the story the past week, do you think we are still on a path to de-escalation? What do you make of the political signaling around that?
A path to de-escalation, is that what you said? Because absolutely not, if that's what you're asking, because it reminds me a little bit of what happened in North Korea right before Kim Jong-un became Donald Trump's best friend. The president was talking about wiping out, you know, North Carolina. We don't want to wipe.
We don't.
No, especially not during this program. But I mean, the president has shown his indication and willingness to switch on a dime when it comes to foreign policy. But that's not the case with Iran. He's always targeted as a foe of the United States. And basically, from the moment that Barack Obama signed that pact with Iran about limiting nuclear capabilities, Donald Trump felt that was a big, big mistake, and since he became president, that was one of his goals, to get rid of it. And so more sanctions, more threatening notes. Yes, we may have dodged a bullet with those missile strikes from Iran the other day, but I don't think there's any de-escalation at all with Iran.
Well, let's look at that and how that's playing out on the congressional level. The War Powers Resolution passed last night, the House of Representatives approving a measure to limit Donald Trump's war-making power. It's a non-binding resolution approved mostly along party lines. What do you think is the significance of last night's vote and the politics behind it as we look at attempts to maybe check the president's actions regarding
Well,
Iran?
Nothing is going to check the president's actions. And I this is true almost any president, because basically the president, you know, the last time the United States declared war was in 1945, even though there have been resolutions like with the Gulf of Tonkin, with Vietnam, and then the Persian Gulf and Iraq. But for the most part, the president has had carte blanche to conduct foreign policy the way he decides and desires, and basically Congress has always been an afterthought. So, but with this case, he never went to Congress, never consulted with Congress, never suggested what he was going to do with the takeout of General Soleimani. So Nancy Pelosi and the House, which has already voted to impeach the president, decided to bring back the War Powers Act from 1973 to basically limit the president from conducting any more foreign policy without authorization from Congress, and it was pretty much on a party line, and again, not a surprise given the fact that the Democrats control the House. The Senate, the Republican-controlled Senate, is another story completely.
Well, yeah, what's your read on how this may play out in the Senate? Some say the Senate passing it would at least make an important statement, even though the president could ultimately veto any joint resolution. Senate Democrats would need at least four Republicans to sign on board. Do you think it's going to happen?
Well, that's why the House passed the House didn't pass a joint resolution.
Right, they did a concurrent
resolution, which means it cannot be vetoed. It was basically a statement from the House saying that the president has got to abide by the War Powers Act, and that's what the Senate will vote on as well. Mitch McConnell can't dodge this vote; he has to have the vote because that's part of the War Powers Act. Already, two senators, Mike Lee of Utah and Rand Paul of Kentucky, have complained about the attack. Both are kind of constitutional/isolationist senators, at least when it comes to foreign policy. Mike Lee was extremely upset with the kind of briefing he got from the Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, and the generals, which he said was insulting. If they can get two more Republicans, maybe Susan Collins, maybe, well, Todd Young of Indiana's name has been mentioned, maybe Nisa Murkowski, whoever, if they can get four, it could pass the Senate as well. But again, it's not up to the president to veto. It's not veto. It's not liable to be vetoed because of the way it's been written. It would be a statement from Congress, both the Democrats and Republicans, that the president needs to abide by some restrictions.
That is the concurrent resolution. I was also speaking about what Tim Kaine was going to introduce that could potentially be a joint resolution that may move forward to a presidential
veto. And again, of course, the even if it would pass the Senate, and that's questionable, yes, the president would absolutely veto that.
Well, looking at some of the Republican kind of interesting statements that have happened this week, Mike Lee calling the briefing insulting and demeaning, Republican Matt Gaetz, who's been called the Trumpiest congressman in Trump's Washington, who signed on with the War Powers Resolution. Do you think that we are seeing some fractions in the Republican Party in response to President Trump's actions in Iran? Or do you think these are going to quiet down, just kind of little murmurs?
It almost reminds me of the reaction after gun violence. Everybody's, you know, up in arms, no pun intended, of course, about the tragedies with gun violence. And then after a couple of days pass, a couple of weeks pass, that disappears and it dissipates. I don't think this, you know, there is some indication that there was some Republicans, voters out there who are starting to sour on the president. But if you look at what's going on in Congress, and you look at the ironclad loyalty that Mitch McConnell has in the Senate, I don't think there's any breaking away of Republicans from the president. If you looked at the only three Republicans, Matt Gaetz, I'll never be able to explain what Matt Gaetz does, but the other two Republicans who voted against, who voted with the War Powers Act, Francis Rooney, he's already indicated that he was open to impeachment, even though he didn't vote for it, and he's retiring. And Thomas Massie of Kentucky is, like Rand Paul, like Mike Lee, an anti-interventionist Republican. So that's not a surprise vote either. Everybody else voted with him, and it'll be very interesting. As we saw in impeachment, no Republican voted for impeachment. So I don't think there's any breaking away from the president just quite yet.
Speaking of impeachment, Nancy Pelosi has now signaled with a letter that she will send articles of impeachment to the Senate as soon as next week. And I want you to talk about Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and your analysis of how he is playing out this political game regarding the impeachment trial. Do you think that there's any chance that the Democrats forcing his hand? It seems like not much at this point. But what are you watching for in terms of his strategy with this?
Well, of course, what I'm watching for is to see if any Republicans come forward to see if they will call for witnesses or call for more documents or call, you know, like when they were talking about the former National Security Advisor John Bolton testifying, he said he would do it under subpoena, but you would have to have Mitch McConnell does not want to have any witnesses. You'd have to have four Republicans again. It would be interesting to see if any of those Republicans do come forward. But, you know, everybody was talking about how clever and brilliant and the strong leadership of Nancy Pelosi when she had to maneuver impeachment in the House. And that's true. She did a remarkable job. But she's up against a tougher opponent in Mitch McConnell. And he argues quite well, convincingly, that, look, you know, you and Nancy Pelosi, you in the House, you had your say, you did what you had to do in the House, you have no say over what's going on in the Senate, this is my body, these are my rules, and we'll do it as we see fit. And of course, it's Mitch McConnell has made it clear that he's working with the president and the president's allies to make this trial disappear as soon as possible. I don't know if there's any truth to this or not, but I was just wondering if one of the reasons Nancy Pelosi is delaying sending this the rules over from the House to the Senate. Now, she said she was hoping to get concessions from McConnell, but it's also the fact that the next Democratic debate is coming up January 14th, and I'm just wondering if Nancy Pelosi, one of the reasons Nancy Pelosi is delaying this is to so it won't interfere with the Democratic debate, because as you know, there are a bunch of senators, Bernie Sanders, there's Elizabeth Warren, there's Amy Klobuchar. They're all going to be in the January 14th debate, and that probably would be not happening if there was an impeachment debate in the Senate. So I'm just wondering if that's part of her reasoning for delaying it as long as she could.
Yeah, well, we don't have much time left, but there is one more debate coming up next week. And my question for you is, at this moment, polls show Bernie Sanders as the top threat to Joe Biden as we get closer and closer to the Iowa caucuses. As you look forward to this next debate and this next cycle of the Democratic presidential process, what do you think Bernie would have to do to push into first? Talk about his appeal and the what he's up against to push Biden.
First of all, what you're talking about, Bernie coming into Biden's support, you're talking nationally. Right now, the last poll I saw was that Pete Buttigieg was leading in Iowa and Elizabeth Warren was leading in New Hampshire. So the race is really, really scrambled. But the fact is, Bernie Sanders has not lost his support from 2016, even though then basically there were only two candidates. Now there's 120. And the fact is that he still has tremendously – raised more money than any other Democrat, including Michael Bloomberg, who's not raising money. He's spending his own money. Bernie Sanders is not the heart attack and the health and the age and all the criticism against him. He's still running very, very strong. Perhaps the only problem he has is the fact that he's splitting his progressive base with Elizabeth Warren, and that could prove interesting as we get into the upcoming primaries and caucuses.
All right. Ken Rudin is the political junkie. No sleep for the weary, Ken. We'll talk to you soon. Thank you so much.
Anita, hopefully next time I'll speak even faster.